This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the opera singer Joyce DiDonato, revered as a mezzo-soprano of exquisite capabilities. The variation in colour she brings to her performances regularly leaves audiences and critics alike spellbound, in awe and admiration. She opens her mouth and makes it all sound, well, utterly effortless. It hasn't been. At 19, a teacher told her she was singing on youth and muscle and that her career would be over before it had even begun. At one point in her early 30s, she trudged round a dozen European opera houses in 2 weeks and was rejected by every single one. But they make 'em tough in Kansas. The years of dedication, discipline and hard graft meant that when her moment to play the great roles finally came, she was ready. And then some. At Covent Garden a few years back, she broke her leg on stage and finished the night's performance on crutches, completing the remainder of the run from a wheelchair. She says, "On a good night, I have the extraordinary privilege of breathing life into masterpieces, and that is a joy." What remains tough is the roller coaster thing, hurtling from the high of having audiences screaming for you to the low of sleeping alone in some horrible hotel where you're overwhelmed by a feeling of unworthiness. And therein lies the rub, Joyce DiDonato. How do you manage that? Because that is much of your life.
It is much of my life. It's interesting that the world of opera is full of extremities. So big tragedy, big love, big conflict, big high notes. And because for some reason I've chosen this career that has that roller coaster that plunges you into the depths and then whips you up to these heights. And it takes a while to figure out how to navigate that. In order to succeed on the stage, I have to be very present in every single millisecond that I'm singing. So if I'm worried about the note that just didn't go very well behind me or the scary one that's approaching, I lose my sense of being now, being here and producing the sound well. If I can just stay present now, somehow I seem to stay in a relatively middle road.
You once said that the voice is just a wild beast that you sort of just hold on to. It sounds like you must constantly be sort of trying to rein in and get under control this professional life you have.
Well, there is an element of that. And I see that when I look at my calendar, and that can overwhelm me. But the truth is, this business feeds me a lot. I can be really exhausted at the start of a show and I hear an overture starting, and that music absolutely gives me energy, lifts me up and energizes me in a way that I feel like I can climb Mount Everest that night. Let's go, let's go. I feel run over by a truck the next morning. But being immersed in such a staggeringly beautiful art form, that is what constantly gives me energy. That and knowing the effect that it has on people that listen to it.
Let's go to the music, Joyce DiDonato. Tell me about your first piece today. Why have you chosen it?
At the end of the day, I like music to help me feel good. And I don't have a single Latino or Mediterranean cell in my body. I'm of Irish descent and I'm as white as they come, but something in my corazón is very Latino or something. Latin music has always really resonated with me, and it feeds me in a way that hopefully I do on stage for other people. So this is a tango, an Argentinian tango. One of the reasons I love this is it's sung by one of my dear friends and colleagues, José Manuel Zapata, and he brings this really, wow, unfiltered and raw exuberance to the way he sings. And I feel that immediately when I listen to it.
Que el mundo fuese una porquería, ya lo sé. En el 506 y en el 2000 también. Que siempre ha habido chorros, maquiavelos y estafaos. Contentos y amargados, valores y dobles. Pero que el siglo XX es un despliegue de maldad insolente. Ya no hay quien lo niegue. vivimos revolcados en un merengue y en un mismo lodo todo manoseado.
José Manuel Zapata with Cambalache from Tango Mano a Mano. For that little bit inside of you that is Latino will forever be Latino. But of course, as you say, there's not a bit of you that is Latino. You the stages that you occupy at Joyce Di Donato, the Met or La Scala and so on, a long way from Tippin's Restaurant and Pie Pantry in Prairie Village, Kansas. That was where you worked as a teenage waitress. Let's ponder for a moment on the subject, the vexed question, I imagine, of perfection. In performance that is transcendental, that sends the audience to that special place, you can't surely think about perfection. Something else has got to happen. Perfection can end up locking in a performance, can it?
Oh, 100%. It can become your biggest enemy as an artist. If my only goal is perfection, I'll be admired as a singer. Say, oh, that voice, it's incredible. Look at what she does. But to make somebody travel to a place, that is when we have to let go. And that's mental work, it's psychological work. It has nothing to do with vocality, has nothing to do with the technique of a singer. It has to happen mentally. And then you have to give yourself permission to just jump off the cliff.
And does it come? I mean, often, you know, people will remark on your performances about the fact that you're a really good actress. Does that come into it too?
Oh, no question. You know, young people write me, they're 20, 21 years old, and they say, what do I have to do to be an opera singer? What do I have to do? And I see this tunnel vision and these wide eyes, and they're very ambitious. And I know that they sit with headphones and listen to opera all day long. And I say, please stop listening to opera, first of all. Go to Europe, go travel, go get into trouble, go live life. Because again, opera is representing the huge extremity of life experience. And yes, we have to know our languages and we have to have our voice in good shape. But if we have nothing to say, if we're just going to attempt to make beautiful sound on the stage, that lasts for about 30 seconds and then I'm bored. I want to feel something. I want that stage experience to help me look inside myself more profoundly.
Let's hear some more music then. Tell me about your second. What are we going to hear?
This was my first real solo. And it goes back to the high school days. I had the most extraordinary high school choir director, Carl Wolf. And he's the first person that really taught me the power of ensemble and creating something of so much beauty that's impossible by yourself. And this was my first solo. My sophomore year in high school, I was probably 14 or 15. And it's called That Young a Child.
That young a child, when it can weep, with song she long let him asleep. That was so sweet.
Benjamin Britten's That Young Child from a Ceremony of Carols sung there by the American Boy Choir. So, Joyce Di Donato, that you said that was your first, you think, solo piece when you were singing the choir. Your father was a choir master, was that right? A part-time choir master? You were very, very close to your dad. Tell me about him.
Yeah, he was an architect. He worked from home, self-employed. He was not a good businessman. He would give his work away for free. But he was a wonderful architect, and he was the volunteer church choir director at our local Catholic church. That was really the biggest musical influence on me, choral music and watching my father conduct the adult choir at church.
And so a connection through music, but a connection beyond music. You would spend a lot of time with him.
Yeah, I miss him. we would talk philosophy and we would talk astronomy. We'd sit under the stars and ponder the universe. What I realize now, looking back on it, was his dream was to be a musician. He grew up in the World War II time, and his father said, "No son of mine is going to be a pansy musician." And so that dream was squelched from the very beginning. To this day, he probably was the person that had the greatest appreciation and need for music that I've ever known. And it brought him great comfort and solace in a sometimes difficult life. So I think it showed me from the very beginning the power of music to actually help somebody, to heal somebody. And I remember he would come to everything that I did. And with every concert, he would say, with sort of this kind of sense of astonishment, "But you're really doing this."
And you were one of seven kids?
I was number six of seven.
You were six of seven. So give me a little flavor of family life then.
Ah, well, chaotic, disciplined. The Catholic faith was the foundation of our family. Sunday breakfast always together. Again, my dad being not a great businessman, finances were scarily difficult at times. So we all started working at the time we were 13 or 14, going back to Tippin's Pie Pantry. I started there when I was 14. We had to pay our way through college. We had to help pay for the vacation. We almost lost our house one time. And I think my father, that really actually drove him quite to a very frightening edge, which he came back from. It was a lot of responsibility. I realize now it was probably too much responsibility for a 13 or 14 year old. But on the other hand, I could handle it. And I was able to help contribute to the family in that way.
Let's have some more music, Joyce DiDonato. Tell me about your third disc of the day. What's this?
So this was my escape. So as all the pressures of the family were mounting up, I would escape to my upstairs bedroom and I'd steal my sister's LP of Jesus Christ Superstar, and I'd grab my hairbrush and I'd turn that volume up as loud as I could. So even hearing my mother go, "Turn that music down," I couldn't hear her. And I became Mary Magdalene.
"Don't you think it's rather funny I should be in this position? I'm the one who's always been so calm, so cool. No lover's fool, running every show. He scares me so."
That was "I Don't Know How to Love Him," sung by the original Broadway cast from the Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice musical Jesus Christ Superstar. And it seemed to me, Joyce DiDonato, you were back in the bedroom, you had the hairbrush, you were right in there. Did you even need a hairbrush? I mean, you must have been aware that you were a terrific singer at quite a young age.
No, quite the opposite. I knew I was musical and I loved the stage and I could sing in tune, but I was never pointed out for having a great voice. The voice is actually the thing that I've had to build, but that did not keep me from nailing this song in my bedroom when I was 12.
And so you were at St. Anne Catholic School. You were in the third grade when your teacher there described you as the perfect student. "I wish all my students were like her."
Mrs. Miller, she sent a note home to my parents. It was, you know, that's significant because that became my identity. I think that happens to kids when they're young. You become the troublemaker, you become the teacher's pet, you become the good student. And that became my identity.
And what did your mother say? Was she full of praise and warmth at this great little note that had come back?
I remember my dad's reaction, not my mom's, actually. I'm sure she reacted well.
So tell me a bit more about your mom. What was she like?
Well, you know, I'm so glad I've gotten older because I have such a better understanding of her now. She was the mother of seven kids with no money and staying at home, and it was really hard on her. I don't think she enjoyed being a mom. She did the right things, but it was my sense was that she was doing it out of duty. So I didn't get along with her. And I think for a long time, you said something about not being worthy in the opening statement. I think that has been something that has been the challenge for me is that what else do I have to do? That was really a fundamental part of my growing up. What else do I have to do to get her to see me? And I happily have left that behind for the most part, but that was a very formative part of my upbringing.
Let's have some more music, Joyce DiDonato. Tell me about your next one. This is, it's your fourth of the morning.
Well, this is still my high school years. And again, either it was in my bedroom with the hairbrush or it was at the piano that I felt understood. This was the one place that I could express myself freely. And I guess a little bit like my father, I started to understand my place in the universe because no other place made sense. So I lost myself in the world of Billy Joel. I could play his music on the piano. And after I'd come home from school, a bad day, the boyfriend didn't pay attention to me that day. And I would lose myself in Billy Joel.
Lost touch long ago. You lost weight, I did not know. You could ever look so nice after so much time. You remember those days hanging out at the village green. Engineer boots, leather jackets, and tight blue jeans.
That was Billy Joel and Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. It was all in there, Joyce DiDonato, wasn't it, in those words?
Those were the days.
Yeah. You studied vocal musical education at Wichita State University in Kansas. You went to study next in Philadelphia. You were studying vocal performance, building your technique. But it was also where you learned, among other things I heard, not to cry in front of the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness me, that sounds tough.
Best lesson, greatest lesson I needed at that time. It's the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, and it's really probably the top place to go and train as an opera singer, perhaps in the world, but certainly in America. And it's tough. You're expected to stand up and to produce. You know, the birth of an opera singer takes so much. Psychologically, mentally, musically, vocally, theatrically. And it's not easy and it's not for the faint of heart. And I didn't understand it at the time.
Well, just tell me about one of the demands, because I read this and I don't know if it's true. The first time that you were rehearsing at La Scala for Riccardo Muti, you stood in front of him. He opened the piano lid, began to play. Tell me what happened.
He asked me why I was singing so poorly. And I, at that time, I'm a professional singer, and I don't think I was singing that poorly. But it's the precise thing that I had learned at AVA, that you have to be so tough mentally. You can get a bad critic. The audience could boo you. The maestro could say, you're terrible. And you have to go deep down and find something within yourself that says, no, I'm going to sing.
And so in that instance, he walks out of the rehearsal. It doesn't even listen to you sing anymore.
No.
And what do you think?
This was a Christmas concert, and I thought, okay, well, at least they're going to fire me, but at least I'll be home for Christmas. Here's the truth about that, now that I look back on it. You don't become Riccardo Muti without an exacting demand for excellence. And he was hearing something that was not excellent at that moment. And I was contracted to sing a concert with the La Scala Orchestra, with Riccardo Muti, at La Scala in Milan on television. And he was right to demand excellence.
Was he right in the way he demanded it?
That's his way. He had this way of either I would have broken or I would have raised the bar and stepped up to the next level. Happily, I didn't break, but I stepped up to the next level. And I'll tell you, that concert was one of the best musical experiences I've ever had. Not easy, but it made me better.
Joyce DiDonato, tell me about your next piece of music then. It's your fifth.
Well, this is, I think, one of the great creations of all mankind, first of all. It's by the Titan, Mozart. One of the first roles I ever sang, I auditioned for Cherubino, the sort of star mezzo role in the opera, but I didn't get it in college. I got Marcellina, the old lady. But then happily I was able to come back and sing Cherubino as a debut role in a number of important theaters. but also simply as a music lover, this is the piece that restores my faith in mankind and humanity. It's the overture to the Marriage of Figaro.
Part of Mozart's overture to the Marriage of Figaro with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, conducted there by Yannick Nisse-Sega. So the reason that you chose that, Joyce Di Donato, apart from it being, as you say, one of the finest pieces of music surely ever created, was that it reminds you of your debut at the Met. That was 2005?
Yes.
Tell me about the hours before. Tell me about what's going through your head.
A lot of nerves, a lot of excitement, a lot of responsibility. There's that idea that if this doesn't go well, I'm finished, which is, again, a terrible place for an artist to be, is in a defensive place. So one of the things I try to do is do a lot of mental work. No, you're prepared. You're ready for this. It's time. This is your moment, you know, and try and go into a proactive mental space.
And what had taken you to the Met by 2005 were these 1,000 tiny little bricks that all had been put in place, and a lot of them were to do with rebuilding your technique, were to do with learning how to work with conductors. Tell me about the time when you went round Europe, and I said in the introduction, there was, by this time you had a manager, you were lined up to do 13 auditions in 2 weeks. You did a dozen, and each person said, nah. Carry on. You're all right. We'll find somebody else. It was that 13th audition where the tide most decisively turned. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the lead up to that was I had spent 3 years from 26 to 29 rebuilding my technique. My voice teacher had said, you have no future. You have to rebuild. And at this point, all my colleagues were whizzing past me. But after rebuilding the technique, I did find management. But it was European management. The European manager found me and said, you have to come to Europe because nobody over here knows who you are. So I said, okay. And we set up a 13-city audition tour in 16 days. And I got 12 outright rejections right away. And it wasn't, she's terrible. It was, we have nothing for her. We already have singers that fit in that area. And my 13th audition, and I was really tired and I was really over it all. And I thought, see, I have no business in this career. It was the only A-level house. And it happened to be the Paris Opera. And about 2 hours after my audition, and I think I sang the same audition that I had for the dozen before. It was the same voice. It was the same presentation. But they called and said, we have a new production of The Barber of Seville. And I broke in at the A-level.
Did you do anything to celebrate when you got that part?
I cried. And I said, what? And I kept saying, are you sure? Are you sure? Really? Me?
Tell me about your next piece of music, Joyce. What are we going to hear now?
Well, it goes back again to these choral days and listening to my father conduct the choir. But also that sense of music giving expression when I don't know what to say. And this is it's the piece we played at his funeral and the piece that brings tranquility in a millisecond. Everything can be out of control, and I put this on and I immediately come back to center.
Thank you.
Randall Thompson's Hallelujah, performed by the Robert Shaw Chamber Singers. Joyce DiDonato, I once read you say an extremely funny thing about the four stages of an opera singer's career.
Yes.
Tell people about this.
Actually, Francesca Zambello first said this to me, a wonderful stage director. And she was giving a talk to us in the Houston Opera Studio. We were very young and eager young artists. And she gave this wonderful context for what we're starting off. And she said, there's four stages to a career. I'll use my name, for example. She said, who is Joyce DiDonato? And then, get me Joyce DiDonato. The third stage is, get me someone like Joyce DiDonato. And the fourth and inevitable stage is, who is Joyce DiDonato?
So you are at the get me Joyce DiDonato or the get me somebody like Joyce DiDonato?
I might be easy. Depends on which theatre. I might be between the two right now.
And living the life you live, as we know, constantly on the road, constantly striving, constantly managing the bookings and the diaries. A considerable strain, surely, on personal relationships, I'm sure. You have been married twice. You are now in a relationship again. Is it to do with, as you explained it, the personal journey and the trajectory and the strength of that personal journey? Or is it a logistics thing that makes it difficult?
Oh, wow. Now, that's a really good question. I will have to ponder this on my own for a while. Mm. I think it is obviously a combination of the two. But ultimately, I would say it is that personal journey. The logistics of having any kind of a relationship in this career are very tricky. You want to be best friends with somebody, but you can't be that person that brings them chicken soup when they're sick. And that's difficult. But ultimately, I know in my case, it really has been about giving myself permission to continue to grow. I've had to reconcile a lot of guilt along the way because, going back to the Catholic thing, you know, you get married and you take a vow and it's for life. And it's a struggle when your reality doesn't line up with what you thought you were going to do. But I know in my case, every instance in my personal life has brought me to much deeper personal growth. And I don't have a single regret.
Tell me about your seventh. What are we going to hear?
Well, this was, I think of this because there was a really cataclysmic event in my life, in the world's life. It was 9/11. And I was in Washington, D.C. the day that this happened. So it wasn't quite New York City, but D.C. was the second area of attack. And I feel like my entire world collapsed in that moment because nothing made sense to me. Here was people in the name of their religion doing something devastating. I went to church that morning and I saw a priest in the most remote way going through the motions. And I looked and I said, but that's this religion here, there's that religion. I was already, religion wasn't making much sense to me anymore in a dogmatic kind of a way. And it just, that part of my world dissipated. It didn't make sense anymore. And it was no longer a place that I could rationally find comfort. So the thing that I turned to was music. And again, music was there to bring sanity back in. And oh, what I would go to was YouTube and In the Name of Love. And I was screaming this out going, can't it just be about love? Can't we just stop the insanity of everything else? And I'm still screaming that out today. And you know, I hope one day we get it.
Oh!
That was U2 and Pride in the Name of Love. So, Joyce DiDonato, I was very careful today in speaking to you not to use the word diva. And the only person who said it at the table is you. Of course, it has all sorts of modern connotations now. But do you rather enjoy sort of swanking through the great opera houses of the world? And do you have a good sort of rider? Do you make sure that your dressing room is painted colour?
No, that's so much work. I find that so much work. I play a character on stage and I love it. I love to disappear on the stage. But I really don't want to play a character off stage. It's exhausting. I want to be me. I've tried that. I tried on
did
that
you?
Coat. Yes.
What did you do?
What did,
yeah.
Well, you know, it's the behavior, it's the dress, and trying to add a sense of mystery. I've tried it and it just doesn't work. And the truth is, I've broken through several other ceilings by being myself. And I think the audience then can relate to me on a more genuine way because it's who I am.
Joyce DiDonato, you know the purpose of this whole conversation is that I'm about to cast you away to an island all on your own with your music. How will you manage practically? I mean, are you somebody who can, you know, gut a fish or wrestle an alligator or plait a palm tree to make a hut?
I can learn. Right now, I don't have those skills, but I'll figure out a way.
I bet you will. Tell me about your eighth, then. What are we going to hear?
Well, it's Sister Helen Prejean, who is the Dead Man Walking nun. She first came to fame through the film with Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon as becoming a spiritual advisor to a death row inmate. But her platform has become so much bigger than that. And I had the extraordinary privilege of now calling her my friend, but I first portrayed her in an opera, and she penned a song cycle, also written by Jake Heggie, called The Deepest Desire. It's phenomenal to hear her talk about this desire to serve. And it's a four-song cycle, and the fourth song, she called it Primary Colors. And the first part of the song, she says, I live my life in primary colors. I let praise and blame fall where they may. I hold my soul in equanimity and give the fruits of my labors to God. And then she says how she finishes her day.
The voice was my castaways, Joyce DiDonato. The piece was The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love, Primary Colours, composed by Jake Heggie, and the music was performed by the Kansas City Symphony. It's time then, Joyce, to send you away with the books. We give every castaway two books. They get the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible, and then they get to take another book too. What will yours be?
My go-to book is called The Power of One, which sounds like a self-help book, but it's not. It's actually a novel by Bryce Courtney about a young boy growing up in South Africa. And it's fascinating and inspiring and long. Okay. So I could take a long time reading it.
Good choice. We also allow you a luxury.
You know, I think I want to... I sound so silly. And I'm assuming I can't bring a masseuse.
You're assuming correctly.
Yeah, okay. Stupid rules. I'd bring some lavender-scented oil.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I imagine it's going to be stressful being on the island, and it will calm me down in a nice way.
Good for the bites, good for the sunburn,
absolutely.
All of that too. It's certainly yours. And finally, if you had to save just one of these 8 discs from the waves, if they were to threaten to be washed away, which one disc would you save?
I think I would save the Jake Heggie. He's a friend, Sister Helen is a friend. It talks about the big picture. So it's going to remind me about what's really important, and I'd be surrounded by friends.
Joyce DiDonato, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.